So hello, good afternoon. Thanks a lot for coming to my session. I know it's the last session of the day, and I think there's some kind of drinking event that comes after this. So I'll do my very best to keep you well entertained. My name is Andrew Schneiderman. I work in the Skype division. I work on Link. Link and Skype are now in the same group. And the team that I work for is a team that's all about talking to customers and understanding what customers want and how we can make our product better. So I love all the conversations, whether it's hear me talking to you or come by after or ask questions or come by our booth down at the exhibit hall. And there's also my email address there, and I'm more than happy for you guys to shoot me emails and whatnot. So I've got this backwards a little bit. What I've done is I've highlighted on the left-hand side of this slide all the sessions that are not mine, because there's no way I can cover everything conferencing related in the product. So if you're really focused on conferencing and you want to do it for yourself or for your customers, go to this session. You're here. That's done. These sessions will round it all out. So I think almost all of these have happened, with the exception of the Link Room System, which will be tomorrow. And I think it's in this room. And Anton, who's actually the lead for developing that product, is going to be here to show it off. And it's a terrific product. I was just talking to Renee about that. So if you're interested in that, come by and check that out. And then Thomas, who did the session right before me on voice, has a session tomorrow on Edge. So that's another area that just don't have enough time to cover. So make sure you hit that one if you're interested. So that's the stuff that will complement this. On the right-hand side is the stuff that I am going to cover. So we're going to start with a demo, because I need to stay awake. And you guys, I want you guys to stay awake. This is interesting, by the way. I've never presented in a room where I can see everybody. So if you fall asleep, actually, it's fine if you fall asleep. But now that you've seen the agenda, this is your opportunity to leave. So you can fall asleep, but if you decide to leave in the middle, I'll give you a dirty look. Anyway, so what we're going to do is I'll jump into a demo. We're going to do our deployment first. We'll go into Topology Builder. We'll just build out a conferencing scenario and show you how easy at a pure deployment level this really is. And then we'll work our way backwards. We'll go into clients. Why would you want conferencing in the first place versus other systems? We'll talk a little bit about all the cool stuff the product does and the different clients that support it. Then we'll go a level deeper and effectively look at the infrastructure. Look at the guts, look under the hood, look at the conferencing servers, look at the different components on the server side that make all this stuff work. Then we'll come back out and I'll pop back into the client just to show you some scheduling features and capabilities so you see what your users' experience is and how you can optimize it for your users. Because one of the biggest challenges we have with Link is it works differently than folks are used to using a lot of these legacy conferencing services. So what can you do as an IT admin to manage that and to make it most efficient for them? And then we'll go back into some slides. I have a whole set of slides on dial-in, because there's still an awful lot of phones out there, and they're going to be around for a while. I think there's quite a few users that use the public switch telephone network. So we need to accommodate those guys. So I'm going to make sure I spend a fair amount of time talking through the details of how to make sure you get PSTN dial-in conferencing working. And then at the very last bit, we'll talk capacity planning. And honestly, I could have made this whole hour and 15-minute session about planning. I just thought that wouldn't be very interesting. And I'm all about trying to entertain you guys. But it's a key piece of it, right? So you want to make sure you do your due diligence with yourself or your customers to do planning. Make sure your servers are sized right, where they're placed. So we'll hit that at the end. So with that, we'll switch over here. And we'll go through some deployment. So give me an idea, before I launch into this, where you folks are at. So who has OCS or R2, one of those variants, deployed in their company? 10%? How about Link 2010? Yay, that's a good half or more. What about Link 2013? So the folks that have 2013, keep your hands up for a second. With 2013, do you have conferencing? And I mean dial in the full Monty video. So you guys can leave. No, I'm kidding. But we'll work our way up through getting to all those rich capabilities. So this guy, we don't use a lot anymore, but it used to be awfully important to us for the folks that still remember OCS. So like most products, you have a set of bits that you deploy on each server, and you would run through this tool to do deployment. And in, you know, we still need to use this guy. Let's see if I can make this a little bigger for you. So we still need to prepare Active Directory, right? So Active Directory is a container for all the link services. So there's permissions we need to create. We need to extend the schema. There's some ACLing that needs to be done. So you got to work with your directory services team to make sure that work's done. One other thing that we're going to have to do, at least in my little example here, is we need to prepare a standard edition box. So I'm going to do SE just to keep it simple and get through the demo in the time we've got. One thing that we have in the product is a central management store. And this is new in 2010. We actually invested a lot of time to build this. So we took all the configuration of Link, the topology, and we schematized it in an organized fashion, and we stored it in an XML document that every Link server gets. So when you're doing a standard edition deployment, there's no SQL server. So I've got to do this first step to make sure I've got a place to publish that initial topology. But after that, you're done with this guy, and you don't need to go back and run this on every machine. Once you do your topology, you can choose to access that topology in a couple different ways. You can run it from the deployment wizard, but you can also just run bootstrapper.exe or enable CS computer. And each computer will then read from this schematized topology and figure out itself what it needs to install. So you guys, as the smart people, decide that, and then we pull it from the database. So enough of this guy. Let's look at Topology Builder. Whoops. So Topology Builder can be done offline. What's typical is you run it on your implementation. It pulls the topology from CMS, and you've got a working set. And then you can manage that working set. You can munge it around. In my case here, we're just going to create a new blank topology. Look at that. I've got a handy file that already exists with a name. We'll make it simple, and we'll just call ourselves teched.com. We'll add a teched.europe.com as well. Multiple SIP domains can become challenging as an IT guy. You need to get in the world of managing additional certificates, managing additional SAN names, managing DNS entries. So as much as you can, work with your company or your customers to minimize that. It's also an identity thing, right? You don't want to have a company that has a whole bunch of different brands. So as much as you can, most of the customers I work with, you know, we've gotten this down to a handful. And this will help you as you manage the implementation. So we'll call this, we'll call our site Spain. In Link, a site is just a well-connected grouping of Link services. We're here in Madrid, and we're here in Spain. And so now I've created my site. So I've got a bucket to put all my Link servers in. The fundamental building block of Link is a pool, and that's how you scale up. And so each region needs to have one or more pools. In this case, we'll do a real simple standard edition pool. Enterprise Edition has higher scalability, higher availability. Justin gave a session yesterday, I believe, on all the HADR bits. So if you're interested in that, you can go back and take a look at that. So we got to give this guy a name. We'll just call it SEO1. Now, starts to get a little more interesting. What do I want to put on this box? Well, of course, we want all the goodness that Link provides. Particularly for this session, though, notice that conferencing and dial-in conferencing are separate. So keep that in the back of your head, and we'll show later why you install the dial-in conferencing component separately. Do I need enterprise voice for conferencing? Absolutely. Remember, we want to make sure that we can accommodate all those folks that are going to be dialing in or dialing out or joining from an endpoint that doesn't necessarily have a Link client. CAC, good to have. CAC's a bandwidth management technique. If you've got small links in one location, you want to make sure we don't oversubscribe that link. Archiving, that's really if you fall under requirements for archiving. And finally, monitoring. Monitoring's a must. So make sure every deployment you have deploys the monitoring server. That just gives us telemetry, detailed information into how each call went, where stuff goes wrong. So we always want to have that role. One of the big investment areas with 2013 is we tried to consolidate roles as much as possible. So in this guy, he's asking us, what do we want to do for a mediation server? So it can be standalone, And if you have a scenario where you're transcoding media, so you're not bypassing that mediation server for media, you want to keep those mediation servers standalone. But if you're able to do that, especially for a small deployment, go ahead and co-locate. And that's what I'll do here. Here's where it's asking me if I want to do Edge. So here's where I'd encourage you to go to Thomas's one-hour session tomorrow. I'm not going to tick that box. But all kinds of wonderful services enabled through Edge, basically firewall traversal and federation, so yourself or your employees or your customers can have all the goodness of Link, but outside your corporate firewall. And what have we got left? SQL. So normally, I could designate a SQL instance that I'd want to store this on, and I could even mirror it and assign a witness for HA. In this case, it's a standard edition box, so SQL's resident on the box. By the way, one bit, really nothing to do with conferencing, but just for awareness, every Link front-end server is a database server now. Every Link front-end server has the full set of RTC databases with your user data and your conferencing data. So you have to treat each box as such. Every box has SQL Express on it, just like our standard edition box in this example. So we need a share. You make sure you define that share before you publish your topology. We'll call it Link Share. That share is used for all the conferencing content. So it's really a very conferencing-centric storage. Whiteboards, polls, uploaded PowerPoints, all those go on the share. Web services, so we publish a lot of stuff, increasingly more and more stuff with a web services front end, a web head through HTTP. So in this case, it's asking me what's the access path internally and externally, and I can differentiate those if I want. Aha, and now we have something new, WAC, or Office Web App Server. And I managed to sit in a presentation earlier today on Office Web App Server. And this is a new server role from Office that is shared. Link uses it, Exchange uses it, SharePoint uses it, and it does native rendering of all the Office document formats in a nice, rich, high-fidelity way to any browser. So instead of us doing our own PowerPoint rendering, as we've done in the past, we're leveraging the service. So Link needs to know about it. And there is, so we'll create a new one. Call it WAC01. Whatever.com, there we go. Oh, by the way, notice this guy. So this little button here. If you do, you can deploy WAC in your perimeter, which might be useful to you depending on your security model if you have folks externally coming in to access it. If you do, you need to tick this box, because what we're going to store in CMS is a set of URLs for internal users to access WAC, external users, et cetera. And the format of those changes depending on whether they're in the perimeter network or not. So we got a WAC server. What's left? So we do need a SQL box. You can't use the same SQL backend as you do for a pool for archiving or the QoE or CDR, the monitoring databases. So we'll put a SQL box in our environment to home those two databases. We'll keep all the default instances, whatnot, and we'll do the same for monitoring. We'll use that same backend, which is a very common topology. Save a little bit. So we're done with our first site. What have we got? Let's take a closer look. So first of all, what don't we have? So there's no more AV conferencing pools, no more monitoring servers, no more archiving servers. Where did they go? Well, we still have all those roles and all those capabilities, but they're all serviced by the front end. So particularly for AV conferencing, if you had an implementation where you intentionally made those standalone because you were intending to do a lot of audio video services, now those are all going to be on the front end. So back to the whole planning discussion, things to incorporate as you're looking at your sizing and your planning. Your pool is going to be taking all that load on now. A couple other things to point out here. Again, nothing to do with conferencing, but we do now treat persistent chat as a full managed citizen in the product. It doesn't have a separate set of management tools, so we have our pchat pools there. And then finally, in shared components, there's our WAC box. And the last thing I'll point out here is simple URLs. So recall that I specified a couple of different SIP domains when I first kicked this guy off. So correspondingly, I've got two different simple URLs. So we'll talk a little bit about, you know, considerations for doing simple URLs. But you can see If you have a whole bunch more, what are there, like 6 different TechEds? So if I had TechEd New Zealand, TechEd Australia, I'm going to have to create DNS entries and certificates and manage SAN entries for all of those different SIP domains. So a planning consideration. I think that is all I wanted to show you on this. So press the magic red button, and we're back. By the way, just a general observation. I did the Tech Ed in New Orleans, and I did this one. And the most beautiful people at the Tech Ed conferences come to the link sessions. You guys are just a really good-looking bunch. So I'm just pleased with our product that we the smartest and the best-looking folks. And, of course, that includes me and all my compatriots here. All right. Yes, video conferencing shows us off. That's why we have it. All right, so let's pop back up for a second and let's talk just a second about why conferencing is interesting in Link in the first place. So these little boxes down the side is all the stuff that we do in the context of a conference. So instant messaging, application sharing, audio, video, those are just core communications capabilities that you can do in peer-to-peer or in a conference. They take on maybe a certain different richness in a conference. Like in video, we can have 5 simultaneous video streams in a conference. Then we have PowerPoint, whiteboard, polls, and scheduling. Those are conference-specific features and scenarios. So you schedule a conference. You have the whiteboard and the PowerPoint rendering capabilities. And then there's a couple of recording, of course, is also a client-side component. And then we also have notes features. So this is really a no-brainer, but I still get a kick out of it every time I'm in a meeting, and I can just hit that OneNote button, shared OneNote, and it points me to a shared location on SkyDrive, and everybody in the meeting can take notes or see my notes. So I don't know why it took us so long to realize that the most frequent thing people do in meetings is take notes, but I was getting really sick of typing on a whiteboard. So now we have this really rich OneNote integration. So that's the capabilities. Let's look at the different clients. And it's a little boggling in this release how many discrete clients we actually make and ship. So on the left, we have the client we're all familiar with, the rich desktop 32/64-bit client. But we also have some companion clients. So Link Web App is one of the neatest ones. So it's built on our new UCWA Web API, and it is the full rich conferencing client capabilities in a web browser. And I actually demo this when I show to customers, and I'll kick off a meeting in the Link client, and then I'll shift to the web client like on another machine, and you can't tell the difference unless you see the browser frame, the browser Chrome. So really full fidelity, exact same features, full audio video capabilities, don't need the Link attendee anymore. Anonymous users can participate with it, so a very, very nice addition. We also have a VDI client. We also have a Link modern client, so a Windows 8 native client. Then we've got some special purpose clients down here on the bottom that maybe don't have all the capabilities. The recording manager, the add-in. If you don't use Outlook, we also have the web scheduler. And the web scheduler now ships with a product. And one additional bit that's neat is if you have OWA, like if you're using an O365, you can now schedule a Link meeting directly from OWA. You just click the online meeting button, and it'll populate it with a join URL and everything, just like it would within Outlook. And of course, we have a IP phone that we make and our partners make that you can join meetings with. And then finally, here's some of our newer clients. We have Link Room System, which is effectively a Link client that's in a room. It's exactly the same features and capabilities just from the richness of a room scenario. And then we have, I think, 4 additional mobile clients, iPhone, Android, Windows, and then iPad client as well, that we ship and we just refreshed with CU1 and Link 2013. And then, of course, we got phones, right? So we can't forget those guys. We have to be able to accommodate PBX and PSTN phones. So a little bit more about the web app. It's HTML5, JavaScript, Chrome, Safari, IE. And what we did is we created an AV plugin for each of those supported and tested browsers. So we actually developed and built a plugin that you can distribute to your users or they can get when they first join a meeting that has the rich full audio video capabilities within the browser. I won't belabor it. Hopefully you guys have seen it. If not, feel free to stop by our booth and we can show it to you. But it's a pretty cool client. What I've tried to do on this set of slides is where I can surface the PowerShell script or configuration options that you guys as IT pros might find useful in installing and configuring and troubleshooting the product. So one of the tricks that I use all the time is this question mark SL equals. It's a little silver light flag that you put on the end of the join URL. And if for some reason you want to force that web client to launch, like in my demo scenario, I want it to run on my machine, even though I have the link client, you just stick that question mark SL equals and that the browser experience will launch. We have some intelligence built in that if you have a resident link client, we'll always prefer that. So if you want to make sure, if you want to show LWIF or you want to force using it, that's the only way to do it. And then finally, we default to LWA because of the richness now in most scenarios. But if for some reason, maybe you're migrating your users to 2013 and they still have the R2 client and you want them still to be able to join with that, there is a PowerShell commandlet. This is a flag to use, show join using legacy client link if you want that capability. So that's LWA, and that's our client story. So let's now look in the bowels of the product and figure out how all this stuff works and how it's all hooked together. So what I've got here is, I think, I don't know, 6 or 10 slides, and they go through each of our conferencing servers. And we have 4 MCUs, our conferencing servers. We have the IAM MCU, we have the application sharing MCU, we have the data MCU, which is the PowerPoint rendering, which is now combined with WAC, and then we've got the AV MCU. So I'm going to go through each of those. How do they work? What are some design considerations and planning considerations, and what are some configuration items for them? So this guy's the odd duck, because people don't think of instant messaging as a conferencing capability. But actually, every instant message that you send, even if it's peer-to-peer, goes through our server. And we do that because it's the only way we can do things like archiving, the only way we can do things like put filters on to manage, you know, putting malicious hyperlinks in or manage file transfers. So this guy, let's get the slide built out. We got 3 clients here, and they're all connected to this IAM conferencing server or IAM MCU. The other thing interesting about this guy is SIP is our call setup protocol. So everything we do to establish a connection, we do within SIP. SIP is actually the transport for instant messaging. So it's encrypted, so you can't read folks. IAM sessions, but you'll see a payload within within SIP that's actually carrying this content. So as I said, everything goes to the server. We have a couple of filters that are built into the product that if you choose, you can use. And I've indicated here, we have 2 ways to manage these capabilities. You can either go through the control panel, which is a web interface, or you can manage all this with PowerShell. And generally speaking, about 90% of the product's capabilities are covered in PowerShell. I'm sorry, in the web interface. But there's definitely some times where you're going to want to drop down to PowerShell. So what I've tried to do throughout these slides is create a reference point for you guys with all the common PowerShell commandlets, as well as where in the web UI these occur. But really, I have more PowerShell in here than the web stuff. But in this case, if you go to the control panel, there's an IAM Presence tab, and you can manage both of these filters there. Or there's CS file transfer filter or the CS IAM filter. And those will help manage what you allow goes across those protocols for your customer. Sometimes you might find yourself or a customer wanting an ethical wall solution, which is a way to prohibit 2 groups of people within the same company from talking. We don't have a product in that space, but partners do. You could build your own if you want, but we do have some rich partner solutions there if that's something you need. So that's our IAM MCU. So what about application sharing? So in this guy, I've got the top guy is actually the sharer, because he's got the double-headed arrow, which is hard to point out in these tiny arrows. But he's the sharer, and those other 2 guys are participating. Now, we do application sharing in an interesting way. We use our RDP protocol, which is the same protocol we use for remote connections, remote managing a server. And we encapsulate that just as we would any media session in RTP. So we get a certain richness with this approach. You can not only share your entire desktop, you can share discrete applications. You not only can share an application, but you can allow, if your policy is configured for it, other folks to take control of that application. So some really rich capabilities. Correspondingly, we do have some controls, because, for example, if you have a meeting with some outside participants, your company may not think too highly of allowing an external participant to remotely control somebody else's desktop internally. So we have a whole bunch of controls to enable who can use these capabilities, how these capabilities are used. And these are all options within CS conferencing policy. So you can manage all those. We added in this release some additional metrics for application sharing, because we found customers were getting inconsistent experiences with the performance of application sharing or the fidelity. So we wanted to give you additional ways so you could look and see what's actually going on the wire. What I'll say is this traffic by nature is bursty. So when you first start an application sharing session off, you'll see a spike as the screen's rendered and set. We tile the screen into individual images, and we send it in effectively like a frame rate across to the other side. So the traffic is bursty, and it's really not suitable for like watching a video. It's meant to look at, you know, shared documents, collaboration. If you do want to share a video, we actually have a way to do that in the product now. You can embed a video in a PowerPoint, and WAC will actually stream that video out to your users. So just be aware of what it is, what it isn't, how to manage it. There's also a bandwidth management flag that you can put in there if you're worried about capping how much bandwidth app sharing is doing. By the way, I know sometimes I talk fast, and I know I'm probably not talking in your native language. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt. If it's something that's going to take me longer, I'll probably tell you to find me later, or hold on to them and catch me later. And I'll do my best to remember to repeat them. So let's go to the AV conferencing server. So this is my favorite by far. It does the most stuff. And it's always been my favorite, but in this release, it's gotten so much better that it's my super favorite. So it's the only MCU that we have that does two things. It does audio and it does video. So what I've done here is I've split it into two. Audio on the left-hand side, video on the right-hand side, and then I've split it into two again, so the upper half, we have what clients are sending, and the bottom half, what they're receiving. So audio is pretty straightforward. Everybody in the meeting that's not on mute, because we're smart about that, if you're on mute, we'll just kill a stream to your machine so we don't take up network. But if you're in the meeting and you're participating, you're not on mute, we'll take all those audio streams, and then we'll mix how we determine are the top five talkers. We'll mix that stream out on the MCU, and we'll send that back out to everybody in the conference. So we're mixing audio on the left-hand side of this guy. Video, we switch. And that's important to us because mixing requires transcoding and then a whole bunch of CPU-intensive algorithms and then retranscoding or encoding. We've always switched video, but in prior versions of the product, we would only switch one. So whoever was speaking, you saw their video. And it was something that was lacking as compared to other competitors' products. So we did a lot of work in this release to do better here. And I think we've done something really neat. We still switch video, which is really important, because you still want to buy a standard HP server or a Dell server to run Link on. You don't want to have a dedicated box with DSPs that cost you $100,000 just for video conferencing. So we still switch video, but we do it in a couple really neat ways. First of all, you, as the participant, can decide who you want to see. So we allow you to selectively subscribe. So you might want to look at your boss, or you might want to look at somebody who's making funny faces, or you might look at somebody who's, you know, interested in the topic, you want to see their reaction. So you can individually pin who you want to see. And the AVMCU aggregates all of these subscription requests and then manages whose video I'm going to request accordingly, and then subsequently whose video I'm going to send out to. And by the way, we'll do this at up to 1080p, 30 frames per second per stream. So we'll send that out to all the different endpoints that have subscribed to them. So that's on the top side. That's the send side. So that's all the folks sending. On the receive side, we do another thing that's interesting. So we know, particularly with all the different clients that we make, that not everybody's going to be able to get a 1080p stream. Maybe you're on a mobile device. Maybe you're on an iPad. Maybe you're on a poor network link. Maybe you're on a machine that only has a single core. and it doesn't have the capabilities to decode an HD stream. So we do something that the client send to the server in RTCP and signaling that we call video source request. And it says, these are the resolutions and capabilities I'm able to receive. So the AVU takes the subscriptions that you want to see as a user, the capabilities that each of the boxes has, and creates a matrix. And then it determines how many, what streams it needs, and then what it sends out to people. So it's doing a lot of really interesting work to give you this really compelling, rich video experience. There's a couple things about how we do it. So we've adopted H.264, which is kind of the industry standard video codec. AVC is kind of the baseline standard, advanced video coding. We've implemented a variant, a superset of AVC called SVC, which lets us do some interesting things like temporal scalability, which is just a fancy way of saying we modify the frame rate. So if I send a 30 frames per second stream to the conferencing server, but I'm on a link that can't accommodate that, I can send a 15 frames per second version to somebody else. So that's the temporal scalability we get from SVC. We still have RT Video or RTVC1 in the product. The 2010 clients will still use that. We don't have 263 in the product. So 263 was kind of our G711 of video codecs. Very old codec, poor quality, SIF quality. We took that out of the product. 264 gives us much better quality experience. And then we do smart cropping, which really has nothing to do with the MCU. It's client side, but I couldn't resist putting it in there because it's cool. We got some work from Microsoft Research that does facial recognition. So when you send the stream, we'll send the full aspect ratio stream, but then we can look at the head, and instead of wasting space with a full aspect ratio, we'll just square the head off. So if you see some screenshots in here, you'll see that we render the videos by default in squares so that you can have the real estate on your screen to show your video and your content and your roster and your IM. And if you have two heads that pop into the window, we'll expand that screen dynamically as well. So that's the AVMCU. A couple thoughts on that. Sometimes folks worry when we talk about this that all of a sudden your network's going to be flooded with video. What I'd recommend is measure twice, cut once, or basically see how it's working on your network. What we've seen in Microsoft's implementation and other customers is there's a novelty period where everybody wants full screen video, but ultimately content wins out, and you want that video representation, but you're not doing HD video for the most part. You're going to relegate that once the meeting's going to the PowerPoint or the Excel spreadsheet or whatever you're working on. So we see stream rates of like 500, 600 kbps each way, even if you have multiple streams enabled. Typically we see 2 to 3 streams and they're not near HD quality. The other thing to consider is if you're really sending HD, the only way to do that is like in one of our room systems where you have a large enough screen to accommodate multiple HD streams. So measure twice, cut once. We do have a network calculator that'll help you make those projections. And we do have some, policy capabilities. So you can turn multi-view off. You can manage the resolution. What I would recommend if you want to play with this is that you look at these last two, video bitrate KB and total receive video bitrate KB. So it controls it each direction. And you just put a cap on it. And then we'll be smart about working within that cap and deciding if you can manage multiple video streams or not. You can also manage this with CAC. And one other thing I've got on this slide is a link at the bottom. So our video PM did a whole bunch of work to do some scenario mapping for you. And this is on TechNet, and the TechNet documentation is pretty rich in this area. So you can take a look at that and see how it works for you. So that's our AVMCU. So I'm not supposed to call this server WAC, but I think it was called Web Apps Companion at some point in the lifecycle, and a name like WAC just kind of sticks. But the official sanctioned name is Office Web App. I think we went through why we did it. Don't need to belabor this. It is a shared service, so you don't need it just for link. You can have one WAC farm in your deployment for everything. Doesn't work too hard. You can virtualize it in many examples. And every link pool can use the same set of WAC servers or you can have separate ones, however you want to slice and dice it. But fundamentally, it gives us the power of the Office team natively rendering documents. And the WAC session I went to earlier today, they were talking about the richness of doing Word documents and Excel documents and their roadmap for this. So potentially with Link using this service, we can now leverage all the investments they make in that product and correspondingly make the way we do content sharing with WAC richer too. So right now it's just PowerPoint. And here's how it works. So there's our data MCU, which we've had in the product since OCS. There's our content share. So remember in Topology Builder, we defined a content share. That's what that guy is. Here's CMS. That's our central management store. That's where our topology is stored and where all the URLs are stored for WAC. Fundamentally, all that's going on here, this slide will turn really ugly and messy with a bunch of arrows. But what's really going on here is we're just shipping URLs around. So we're just giving the clients a set of URLs to get the stream from the WAC server. So that's why those URLs are stored in CMS. And that's why you need to configure it initially in Topology Builder. So the blue box is Link. Here's our WAC server sitting in the perimeter, sitting anywhere in your organization. Here's our Link presenter. So he joins the meeting. What he does is actually, just like he would in 2010, is he uploads the content through the data MCU to the content share. Then an attendee comes. Now, the attendee also, first thing it does is go to the data MCU. And the data MCU is going to respond with a token and a URL, which it's going to then send redirect it to WAC. WAC's going to get that. WAC is actually going to go to the share. The share is always resident on that. I'm sorry, the file is always resident on that share. WAC never has it. But it'll take an initial cache copy of it to render. And at that point, the client gets back a broadcast URL. You also can have a private view, so you can click to preview ahead in the slides, assuming that's enabled. So there's a private URL you'll get, too. So you actually get multiple URLs, depending on what you want to look at. And then the 2010 attendee doesn't know about any of this. He can still participate in the meeting, but he'll get the same 2010 experience going directly to the data MCU. So if you have a mixed environment, the presenter will upload a version in the legacy format. We render it with the pictures as opposed to the native format in 2010, as well as 2013. And every client will be using this. So the iPad client, the tablet clients, for getting content. So this enables us to have this kind of richer experience across a multitude of devices. So that's WAC. There's a couple of additional configuration options that I think are interesting. So port ranges sometimes become very important if you're in a deployment where you want to implement some quality of service. A lot of times we define how you're going to mark packets with that DSCP marking to prioritize them by a port range. So if you're in that boat, you can specify in SetCS conferencing configuration application sharing, audio and video to use discreetly different and separate port ranges. And then your routers can correspondingly see any traffic within that port range, I want to mark it for a priority queue. If it's audio, I want it to be expedited forwarding, and I want to put in a priority queue so I get I don't get a network effect and reduce the quality of my calls. So that's one important bit within that commandlet. We also have some flags to manage content. So if you don't want stuff sticking around on that file share, there's a grace period and the maximum size of the storage, et cetera. I showed you in Topology Builder how we need to configure the URL. If you decide you want to use that capability to upload videos, you may find your PowerPoints are getting big. So there's a way, if you edit the WAC.xml, to increase the default size from 50 megs. Right now, WAC has a hard limit of 50 meg max for an upload, but you can increase that by editing that XML. And then this last bit I threw in there is a ResKit tool that'll enable you to manually manage content. Say somebody leaves your company and you want to delete all their content or find their content, you give it their SIP URI and it'll let you manage it. Quick hit on archiving. Archiving is interesting because we have a brand new service called the Link Storage System that's an abstraction layer that we added. So no more MSMQ. We just use lists. And remember before, monitoring and archiving are now resident on every front end. So every front end has a local list database that it puts content in, and then that's committed to the monitoring store and to the archiving store. So let's list. List also lets us go directly into an Exchange mailbox. So you can also archive directly into Exchange now. From a conferencing perspective, this is interesting in a couple ways. We still archive IMs by the IMs going out through lists, and they either land in Exchange or in SQL. But the new bits are the data MCU content, like a whiteboard, will also be archived now. So it's stored as an XML file in either Exchange or your archive database. And we actually shipped an XML viewer. So you can take that XML content and render it in a web page. So for recovery purposes or discovery, you can get it. And we also archive all the content. So if you upload PowerPoints, et cetera, those will end up in your archive database too. So who went to the HADR session yesterday? I did. So that's why my hand's raised. I sat way up there, and I almost fell asleep. But that was because I was jet-lagged, because it was a very interesting session. This is my attempt to take that whole hour and 50-minute session and just boil it down to you guys from a conferencing view so you understand how HADR impacts link and conferencing. So one of the best things about the new HADR work we did is what it does for conferencing. So in 2010, if you failed, if you had a failure, you went into voice resiliency mode. And you still could place and make phone calls, but you were out of luck if you wanted to schedule or attend a conference. Now, we replicate all the conferencing data. And even if you have a full pool failover, you still have full conferencing fidelity. So let's see how it looks. The blue box is high availability. So that's resiliency within a local instance, right? A local data center. And the three things I care about, because I'm the conferencing guy, are conferences. So the actual conference entries, those are in the RTC database. Conference directory, we're going to talk about that. That's very important to manage dial-in users and those conference IDs. And meeting content, right? The PowerPoint and whiteboard and that kind of content I want to render. So let's fill this whole slide out. There's three pieces here. The first thing we do is use Windows Fabric in red. So that's the replication technology that groups three front ends together in a primary, secondary, and tertiary and replicates all the data within them. So if you lose one front end, it's okay. One of the other two will take over. Second thing we're doing is protecting that RTC database. That's done with a SQL mirror and potentially also a witness, so you can automatically fail over. No more SQL clustering. We're using simple SQL mirroring now. And then finally, meeting content. You can protect that in a variety of different ways. Here I'm just using DFS, but a clustered file server would work here as well. So that makes sure that should any one of these components fail, I still have service. No single point of failure. But now what if I lose that whole rack? Or what if something awful happens to my data center? Or what if somebody cuts the network cord to that data center? So here's where we have disaster recovery, which is the green box. So I have a brand new service called the backup service. And it's going to replicate to another pair, a paired server. It's going to push all that data out. And that server subsequently is going to populate meeting content in the RTC database. That's HADR in the compressed 5-minute version. So let's take a breath. I know I threw a lot of stuff at you. How does this look in terms of a sample topology? How would it look as you guys look to deploy? So here's a simple example. So I've got North America. I've got EMEA. I've got a pool in North America. I've got to have three or more front-end servers in my enterprise pool. I've got a SQL instance in a mirror. I've got a bunch of shared services that every one of my pools can leverage. So I've got my CMS database. There's one master, but there's going to be an instance of that on every link server. There's my monitor and archive database, typically one per implementation. Since every single front end is now a monitoring and archiving source, we have a much better resiliency story here. You don't need to have more than one monitoring server, particularly if that guy's protected with a SQL mirror. WAC servers, however many you want, wherever they're at, you scale up WAC just by adding more servers and putting a load balancer in front of it. Content shares. I threw Exchange in here because I felt bad leaving it off. Really don't care about Exchange for conferencing. But if you're doing enterprise voice, you need Exchange for voicemail. So now I've got some additional services I need to provide. I've got to have a way for those phone users to dial in. So I've got a mediation server, one or more that are going out to the PSTN. And then I've got my perimeter services, a reverse proxy, and edge servers that enable all the capabilities that I have within my firewall outside my firewall, including nice stuff like Skype Federation and Federation with other companies. And then in whatever other regions I determine, in this case, I've got a second data center in EMEA, I can have another pool or pools. And the other thing I've put in here, there's no reason that you can't use standard edition servers instead of or in addition to some of these EE pools. Potentially, there's some other stuff like what you get in the branches. But again, that's more voice-centric. Fundamentally, this is what your deployment's going to look like in some larger or smaller subset just to do conferencing. Okay, so that's kind of how it works and how you can configure and manage it. Now let's look at schedule and join. So to do that, we're going to pop out of here again, and let's look at, you guys can see that, yep. So let's look at how this looks from a client and then how correspondingly you can optimize that. So a couple quickies in the client that you may or may not be aware of. This guy's a little sluggish. First one is Meet Now. So real quick way to spin up a meeting, good troubleshooting, good thing for your users to know, great way to just ad hoc have a meeting. Notice this dialog box. As you deploy conferencing, your users may not be comfortable joining audio from their PC, or they may have a phone next to them with a headset, or they may be coming off a PBX phone. There's no reason they can't join from whatever endpoint media, whatever endpoint they're interested in. So in this case, I can just say call me at, and whatever numbers I have published in Active Directory, like my mobile, will be there. So if, for example, I'm down at the exhibit floor and the Wi-Fi here is pretty poor because everybody in the world's using it, I could join that meeting for content, but then use my phone to join the audio portion. Neat bit when you're first starting out, you want to make sure that's enabled. This capability is configured down here. Within the client, you can also configure it with policy. So by default, it'll always ask you how you want to join. Another interesting bit. Yep, there's my beautiful video. Like I said, we're the beautiful people. Especially when you freeze us. So this is something we added in CU1. So if you have a scenario, like my boss likes to use his camera in his office, but he's always got a couple people sitting in there. He doesn't want that squared off video view, so we put this tick box in there. So we'll do the full aspect ratio view if you like. And then last bit is you can now have multiple Link clients on the same box. Because you can install Link 2013, and it'll leave Link 2010 and even Communicator there. Or you can have the rich Windows client. So this one lets you say, which of these clients, without messing with file associations, do I want to use as my default meeting client? You want to do that if you install both the Windows 8 client and the desktop client. All right, so let's look at the scheduling add-in. New Link meeting. Notice it populates the body right away. Notice the simple URL is gone. I guess it wasn't that simple because now we just have a big arrow that says click here. But if I hover over that arrow, we'll see my simple URL is still there. Couple other bits in the body. We have a reference to our dial-in page. So each one of you will have a corresponding dial-in page. And here's where we publish every dial-in access number and the languages it uses. So that's how customers can find different dial-in numbers to use. You want to think about that when you're building those dial-in numbers. We also have a link to the PIN, so you can manage your PIN, which is another dial-in join option. Couple other things on options. First of all, phone. So if I was scheduling a conference call with folks outside my region, let's see if I can find Spain. I know it's in here. Aha. I can say, most of the folks are going to be joining from Spain. So in this case, it pulls the conferencing access numbers from that region, from the dial plan for Spain, and it populates a local access number for Spain. Oh, one other important thing to point out in this guy is this conference ID. When do I use that? So if I dial into a call and it says, welcome to the conference, what conference do you want? That's the number I've got to type in, so Link will figure out what conference to join me to. So that conference ID becomes very important in join scenarios. Real quick, another important bit. So by default, every single user uses the exact same meeting every time. It's their kind of dedicated or reservationless meeting. And you can actually put that URL in your signature or send it to folks, and they'll click on that, and it persists in our database, and it's always active. And you can always spin up a meeting with that. The downside to that is any content that you share, or if you have overlapping meetings, you can have meeting collisions. So I had a scenario where I was having a meeting. It was an internal meeting. I'd shared some content, and all of a sudden, a customer joined because I went a few minutes over. Not what you want. So you can manage this with policy, and I'll show you how. But you may want to consider making each meeting a new meeting, and then you get some other options. And these are important, too, because you need to, first of all, you don't want people that dial in waiting, listening, waiting in the lobby. So dial-in users can just bypass lobby, get right in. But the more important thing is you want to allow people that are in your organization in, because somebody has to open a meeting. Link has no concept of an anonymous meeting. It's really common for traditional dial-in bridges. For Link, somebody's got to open that meeting. It's a security issue. So you need to make sure you have a way in your use cases for meetings that they're opened. You also can manage some additional stuff like who's a presenter, announcements, whether people join muted, et cetera. So what does this mean to us on the back end? Back to slides. So what happened when I said make a Link meeting? So the server, the Outlook client, goes to something we call the Focus Factory. We have a bunch of elements in the back end that create and manage conferences. In this case, the Focus Factory is responsible for cranking out focus instances or conferences. And the focus, when you click on that URL to start the conference, it starts this focus instance, and it manages the conference, who joins, who leaves, what policies affect, et cetera. So it gets, it checks your policy, it goes back against the server, and it returns in a 200 OK what is the ID for that conference, what's the conference ID for that conference, what's the simple URL, and that's how that gets populated in the meeting body. And then once you click send, we say, okay, we're done. I'm going to put an instance of that conference in our RTC database, and I'm also going to put it in your Exchange mailbox. Exchange is the only place that has a notion of when that meeting starts and when it ends and how long it was. Link doesn't know. Link doesn't care. That's what happens when you schedule. We have the big new bit in the space is a customized invite, and I think I have a slide on that. So we'll wait for that. Look at that. Here it is. Somebody told me, our conferencing PM told me, this is a surprise to me, that this was the most requested feature in Link 2010, that we give customers a way to customize that meeting request. So here it is. And what I've done in this slide is I've showed you on the left how it looks in the web interface, so the control panel, the Link control panel, and on the right, how it looks in PowerShell. So you can see it's almost identical. Every single option we have in that web interface, we also have a PowerShell parameter for. So here's where, for example, assigned conference type by default, that's the last thing I showed you on the client, where instead of having the same conference ID, it's unique every time. So that's how you can set that via policy. And some other policy items are reflected there too. By the way, the stuff on the bottom, the logo URL, the legal URL, the help URL, custom footer text, that will customize all those elements in the meeting body that I showed you. You put your company's icon and a disclaimer, et cetera. When I was writing this deck, I found one thing that I didn't recognize. So this is the only thing that's not in the web control panel. Require room systems authorization. I had no idea what that was, but so I asked my buddy, who's one of the PMs on our Link room system team, and if you want LRS to always require authentication, you tick this parameter in PowerShell. By default, only meetings that LRS will require authentication for are meetings that you designate as private. Otherwise, you walk in an LRS room and tick the meeting, opens it up, and you're off and running. So this is just an example of how PowerShell will expose some additional configuration options you won't find in the web user interface. Okay, simple URLs. Three ways to do it. Topology Builder defaults to the one on the far right. Microsoft IT uses the one in the middle. I've never seen a customer use this one on the right because it's really ugly. But if you had a situation where you had a whole bunch of SIP domains, it's the only one that'll save you the grief of creating a whole bunch of certificates and DNS entries, because you can see the DNS prefix is identical for every single one, and we're just specifying the SIP domain after it. So things to think about as you're planning for SIP, simple URLs, get it right the first time. it's kind of a pain to go back in and decom a URL and create a new one, and your users' meetings will stop working if you retire the old URL. There's Topology Builder, you can manage that, or there's a commandlet, CS Simple URL commandlets for that. Okay, so now I've made the meeting, I'm clicking. What happens when I click on that simple URL? So here's the URL, I parse it, the client parses it. I know the SIP domain, Microsoft.com. I can recognize the organizer because I know the format of that simple URL. I know the conference ID. I can create the organizer's URI, and then I can create this. Not so simple. This is a unique SIP URI that's actually in our RTC database. So every conference has one entry in the database for this. So that's how we get from that simple URL to this guy. So then when I click, what's the workflow going on here? So I look up join.microsoft.com, because that's how Microsoft does it. That's how our IT group created their simple URLs. I get a return for an A record that points me to either a pool or a director. I may be going through Edge, so it'll redirect me through a publishing rule. I put an HTTP GET, and that GET tells me a little information, like what clients are running on my machine. And then it'll let me know if I want to use LWA, for example, instead of a client, if I don't have a suitable client. So I get a response with that SIP URI and a URL for the web join. And then there's two ways we join. The legacy way is through the focus. But all of our new clients, including LWA and all the mobile clients, will join through UCWA, which is our web API. So think about this a little bit. How do you want your users to join? If you have a whole bunch of users that are going to be accessing it from a phone that doesn't have a link client, this is where you got to give this a little thought. And I'll repeat this point often. But these options were shown in that screenshot I had before. But these options will allow you to do some important things. So PSTN callers bypass lobby. So if I dial in, put me in the meeting right away. We don't worry as much about a PSTN caller because they can't see content. They can only hear. So we don't put them in the lobby by default. I think that's a good behavior. You probably should maintain that unless you have a problem not to. Designate as presenter. Make sure somebody can open up the meeting that's not dialing in from a phone, because it's kind of painful to do it when you dial in. And then this last one is the private conference versus the public conference. So these are some parameters for that. So with that, we're going to use most of the 17 minutes I have left to talk about getting dial-in conferencing right. So how does dial-in conferencing work? This is kind of important as you figure out where you're going to put your pools and how your users work. So top right, I have a pool, and that pool owns the access number. So when I create a dial-in access number, it's associated with a pool. That pool owns the access number. The conferencing attendant, you'll see a service actually running that. That's the guy that answers the phone and says, welcome to the conferencing service. Pool on the bottom is where my conference is actually hosted. So that's where the user who scheduled the conference lives. The conference is always going to be hosted on a single pool, and it's going to be the organizer's pool. He's got another additional service called the conferencing announcement service. That's the one that announces people as they come and go. It injects itself into the conference, and it lives in that bottom area. And of course, we've got our MCU down there, and we've got our guy calling in on the right. I'm sorry, the left, through the mediation server. So I pick up the phone. I dial 1-800-CONTOSA, whatever my access number is. Mediation server finds it, goes through inbound routing. It finds the pool it's homed on. CAA, that was just perfect timing because the CAA arrow here. So pretend that was CAA chiming in, says, what conference do you want to attend? At that point, it does a conference ID lookup. And here's where those conference directories become important, because I have to take that numeric ID. Remember I showed you in the meeting request? Sometimes it's like a 10-character number. When I put that in as the person attending it, I have to look that up against the alphanumeric one to find out the conference URI to attend to. So it does that. Now it knows the pool that I need to join on. It does a transfer, effectively, to a focus to manage that conference on the new front end. The conferencing announcement service is added. It's optional. You can turn announcements on or off. In this case, it injects itself in the call. It announces the users. And at this point, the green is media. So at this point, my media stream is shifted. I do a replace, and now all my media is going to my second pool. So initially, the media goes to the pool that the dial-in lands on. And once I figure out the conference I go to, the whole thing's transferred over to the pool that's hosting the conference. So the signaling bounces around all over the place on this slide. The thing to remember is it's always going to be on a single pool, and the media is ultimately going to, most of your media traffic is ultimately going to go to the organizer's pool. So what about these conference IDs? So we have in the simple URL, there was an alphanumeric, but the conference ID is all numbers because you need to punch it in on, you know, your 4x3 dial pad. That conference ID can get hard to find, and it can get really long. So if you have a deployment with over 1,000 users, at the very beginning of the deployment, create one conference ID for every 999 users. And that'll, to some degree, manage the length of that conference ID. In Microsoft, if I created a new meeting, if you caught it when I was going through it, it's about 9 characters long. And if I create a private meeting, it's 10 characters long. So, you know, it's painful to put all those numbers in when you're dialing in. You're on the subway or something like that. So create a bunch of conference directories and manage your deployment so your users don't have to go through putting these conference IDs in as much as you can. So a better scenario than dial in is dial out. So there's no reason I can't add somebody to my conference. In this case, I've got the same pool, but I've got a couple of dial-out scenarios. So the most common one is I'm dialing out to a PSTN user. So I'm dialing out to someone's cell phone. They say, hey, just call me, and I'll pull you into the meeting. That's a real common one. Maybe I have an old PABX phone or mobile handset. I can remember when I showed that join dialog, I can join from any number I designate. So that's another good experience because I can authenticate you natively. And then finally, our mobile clients give you two ways to join. We'll call you back. We call that call via work, and that would actually go through mediation. Or with a 2013 mobile client, you can bypass all of this. And if you have Wi-Fi or a decent cellular data connection, you just do IP voice and potentially even IP video, because the mobile clients all now support native VoIP and video over IP. So these are preferable. There's a couple of configuration options that are interesting to you here. The one I want to focus on is the one on the right. We had a problem in the 2010 version of the client, in the 2010 version of the product, that if you were just doing conferencing, just doing conferencing, and you weren't enabled for enterprise voice, we didn't allow these dial-out capabilities because we had no dial plan to associate with you. So we had no way to route the calls. But it was a problem because you might be doing a full conferencing deployment without enterprise voice. So we fixed that. In 2013, there's a flag, allow non-enterprise voice users to dial out. And as long as somewhere we can get to a voice policy, we're fine. So as long as there's a global voice policy defined, or if the organizer of the meeting is at least EV-enabled, so we'll use that organizer's voice policy, it enables the scenarios for users to join via dial-out and they're not EV-enabled. So remember when I showed you that dial-in page and we showed all those phone numbers to dial into? So as you deploy conferencing, you can see in Microsoft, we have 3 screenfuls of those access numbers now for every country that we have an office in. So that'll start to grow, and you want to make it natural for your users to find them. So you need to think about this. This is how it works. Every dial plan, and dial plan is a collection of routes and normalization rules, so it's really region-specific for specific dialing patterns and behaviors. Each dial plan has a single region. Each region can have one or more access numbers that you define. And then each access number has a name, a friendly display name, like, you know, Redmond Central or different campus names. You can distinguish within a region by the friendly name when I'd use one number over another. It's tied to a pool. It has a primary language. It also can have up to 4 secondary languages. Remember when I put in the Spain dial-in numbers and it showed that it not only, that conferencing number not only would speak English but also Spanish? So that's where you can specify multiple languages. And then it's mapped to one or more regions. And then if you do this right, you'll get a nice rendering of the dial-in page. And more importantly, when your users create a conference, it'll be automatically populated with the right dial-in numbers. And then if they decide to change it, they can easily find the set of dial-in numbers that they want. So important to define those well. Use simple names. This bit I've got at the very bottom is if you want to prioritize different access numbers, there's a PowerShell commandlet that'll do that. There's always a PowerShell commandlet that'll do it. So in this case, set CS dial and conferencing access number will do that. So what does this all mean as you're looking to move away from a bridge or a traditional audio conferencing provider? As much as you can, encourage your users to join natively through Link or through a Link client. The experience is much better. Let me explain to you, if you haven't experienced it yourself, how it works if you try to join authenticated with a phone. First, you have to find that conference ID and put it in. And then you have to say, yes, I'm a leader. And then you have to put your phone number in so I can figure out what your identity is in Active Directory. We do a lookup based on your phone number. And then you have to put in a PIN. So typically, by the time you're done doing all that stuff, you look like the angry guy up there. It's not the best join experience. So what you want to do is work with your users, work with your phone folks to make sure that you have a best join experience you can. And this is a lot of the same things I've talked about, a way to make that optimal. So you can manage, so DTMF tones are the same as your current bridge service. You can turn announcements on or off, bypass the lobby, make sure you can authenticate. By the way, if you do have users that will be authenticating, you have to publish their tel URI in Active Directory. It's the only way we can do that authentication over the phone. So you have to populate the tel URI. This is neat. So second from the bottom, there's actually a commandlet that'll send a welcome email. Say, hey, welcome to Dial-In Conferencing. Here's how you set your PIN. Here's what your PIN is. You can customize that. There's just an HTML template so you can manage it for your organization. So it's a good way that folks have a reference point, and you can resend that at any point in your deployment that you want. So it's a little bit of an adoption thing. We also have a whole team that has written this really rich set of adoption tools called the Rollout and Adoption Success Kit. Encourage you to check that out. Link is only as good as the users that are using and loving it. So you may do the best job at designing and architecting it, but if they're uncomfortable with a new and different experience, it won't be successful. So spend a little time to make sure you get adoption right. Okay, so here's the very end bit that we talk about planning. So I tell my kids, what is it? Fail to plan, plan to fail. They don't listen. But you can go through Topology Builder in about an hour and you can set up a Link deployment. But to do it right and to make sure you don't run into troubles down the road, you want to take a little time and make sure you do some capacity planning and some modeling on where your server should be and network modeling, that kind of stuff. So we've got a really rich set of tools and resources for you guys to do this. So let me go through them real quick. So first, we have a whole capacity planning guide up on TechNet. We also have a bandwidth calculator that came out in the last month or so. And it's an Excel spreadsheet. You define some personas. Where are your users? Where are your servers? What are they going to be doing? And it'll actually crank out projected bandwidth for every WAN link that you have. And you can actually see what your links are and if you're oversubscribed or if you have enough or you should add bandwidth. So do some modeling on usage and bandwidth. Because if you do roll it out and you don't have enough bandwidth, or if you're not implementing QoS or you're dropping packets and you have poor quality, that's another thing that'll kill your deployment. So make sure you do the right modeling and the right network level configuration to make sure you have a good quality. We also have some planning tools. So we have an application that we ship, and you put in your users and your data centers and what you're going to be using the product for. You go through like 10 screens typing in information, and it pumps out a Visio of your topology and how many servers you should buy and what specs the server should be. It's a really good first pass at how your deployment should look. We also have a capacity calculator, which you can put in for a pool. It's on a pool basis. How many users will be on that pool? How many will be doing video? And it'll crank out by CPU cycles, by memory, by network. What am I missing? Disk that you need in terms of pure core compute resources to run Link. So that's another great resource. And then if you're running a really big design or you're doing some weird stuff, like doing really big meetings or a lot of meetings, we have a stress tool. So you can build a lab up, and you can pull the stress tool down. It's a variant of the same tools we use when we ship the product, and you can stress against your build. And you can look at a set of key counters and decide if you're going to be okay or if you need a different hardware build. Finally, rollout, and this is iterative, right? So rollout, check with your users. Is quality okay? Look at QoE. Are you dropping calls? Are your dial-in users pissed off because of some of the things I've covered? Are there ways you can do training or ways you can change some configuration so they're more comfortable with it? And then keep an eye on it. You're never done with Link, unfortunately. It kind of gets hold, and people start to use it, and you think it's running great, and all of a sudden usage spikes, and quality goes sideways because maybe you have a network issue or some other issues. So you need to ongoingly monitor and maintain. Last slide. What do I want you to do? So hopefully I've given you all the information to go out and just deploy conferencing. And if I haven't, come up and talk to me and send me an email. But here's a summary. So first thing to do is the last thing I told you, which is do some planning. So capacity planning, look at your geography, where are your data centers, where's your network, figure out where you're putting Link services. Think about firewalls and load balancers and SBCs and dependent infrastructure like that, because Link needs all that stuff, DNS servers, et cetera. Then go through Topology Builder, configure your topology, build some servers. Get your simple URLs right, figure out how you're going to do WAC and Edge. Make sure you've got monitoring deployed. Dial in. Make sure you have mediation servers. Make sure you have gateways. Make sure you have a way for calls to get out to the PSTN. Make sure you think about how to define those access numbers and where you're going to how you're going to have folks dial in. What path is that call going to take? Finally, make sure you have you've done all the policy management. You've enabled conferencing. You've customized config. You've sent out your welcome to conferencing emails, and then you're finally in your run state. And here's where you want to pilot and tweak and make sure you got SCOM running and you're keeping an eye on things as you go and looking at quality. And that's it. And we have this slide, and we have this slide. And do the eval if you ever want to see me on a stage again. It's a good thing to do. Let us know how we did. And I got a couple minutes left for questions. And thank you.